Pushkin. My name is Malcolm Gladwell. Welcome to this special episode of Revisionist History exclusively for Pushnik subscribers. Behind-the-scenes moments, bonus material, digressions, and more. Today, a look back at an episode from our latest season about a woman who absolutely baffled me. In the archives of UCLA's library, there is a remarkable 7-hour interview conducted in 1988 with a woman named Helen Sloat Levitt. Along with a separate interview with Helen's husband, Al Levitt. Each conversation spanning an extraordinary period: the Great Depression, the Second World War, the Cold War, the Civil Rights Movement.
What I'd like you to start with is your biographical background, when and where you were born, your parents, your family, etc.
Fine. My roots are solidly middle class, Jewish, Brooklyn, out of Poland.
That's a clip from my latest season of Revisionist History. I asked you, the listener, to judge Helen. She was a self-proclaimed communist at a time when the Communist Party, under Joseph Stalin, committed horrific atrocities. But when asked about Stalin, Helen was largely unfazed.
The general attitude we took in terms of any attacks against the Soviet Union was that the establishment here had so much at stake to undermine any success in the Soviet Union that you couldn't believe anything. We justified everything. The Nazi-Soviet pact did not bother us. We really trusted Stalin, that he knew what he was doing.
But Helen is only half of the story. Her husband, Al, also sat for hours of interviews with the historian Larry Sipler. I think that story, Al's story, is one worth hearing. The beginning of Al's life is similar to Helen's in many ways. Like her, he grew up in New York, joined the Young Communist League in college. After he and Helen got married, they drove across the country to start a new life in Hollywood. Al dreamed of becoming a screenwriter, but his timing was bad.
You're on the verge of being hired as a screenwriter and you get drafted.
Right.
What happens then?
So my draft board was the only one in Los Angeles that sent people out of Los Angeles for the physical. They put me in a bus, sent me to Fresno with a group of others from that draft board for my physical and then back. I mean, it was really insane. And then when I went into the Army, I was stationed at Culver City at what was familiarly known as Fort Roach for a year and a half. You know about Fort Roach, I assume.
Hal Roach Studios.
It was the Hal Roach Studios that were taken over by the government for the first motion picture unit.
The first motion picture unit was part of the Army Air Forces during the Second World War. They made training films and newsreels.
She was the B-29, the Superfort, with 2,200 horsepower in each of four engines, with a fuel capacity equal to that of a railroad tank car, a tail that climbed two stories into the air, a body longer than a Corvette.
Avid listeners of Revisionist History may not just recognize that voice, but that very clip. Ronald Reagan narrated many of these films. Red-loving Al Levitt and red-baiting Ronald Reagan were actually co-workers.
Every day for a year and a half, I would see Ronald Reagan, then called Reagan, who arrived at the post. He arrived there before I did, but he arrived from a cavalry outfit wearing jodhpurs and a campaign hat, and nobody could take him seriously from then on. He was a laughingstock.
Al saw the turning point in Reagan's politics, where he set out on a course that would eventually land him in the Oval Office.
There was a strike in one of the public utilities. I don't know whether it was water and power or telephone or what it was. Anyway, he came in that morning in absolute fury, and he said, "I'm a good union man and all that." He said, "But this is inconvenient." And his choice of the word inconvenient stayed with me forever. I mean, I was so stunned. I was waiting for him to say, "This is a pain in the ass, at least," or "This is, you know, whatever it was." But inconvenient just seemed like such a strange choice of words for something that was going to change his political orientation. Yeah. It has stayed with me.
Fort Roach, as it was known, was a bizarre place during the war, part army base, part movie lot. The actors were at the same time active duty military and performing for the cameras.
What was embarrassing was the attitudes of some of the other people at that post. And I did not want to identify myself with some of them. I mean, this was a place where, as you walk onto the post, guys would come up, not to me, but to others, and they'd come and they'd feel, and they said, "Who did your costume?" And a lot of the guys had their uniforms made. They wouldn't wear GI stuff. They referred to uniforms as costume. Eventually, a new commanding officer, a West Point guy, came in there, and after he was there a while, there was a notice on the bulletin board that said, "The clothes you wear are uniforms, and they're not to be referred to as costumes. These premises are an army post. They're not to be referred to as the lot or the studio," and a whole series of things like that that were ridiculous.
Ridiculous. But despite frustrations with lack of decorum, the first motion picture unit was actually a big deal for Al's career. Before the war, he'd been a reader, a low-level position in Hollywood, where your task is to read scripts endlessly, simply to see if they're worth the time of someone more important.
What was your job at the FMPU?
Well, you know, it's funny, when you, on your record, your army record is your last employment. It says last employer, Paramount Pictures. Department, story. They don't know that the story department is what the readers work in. They assume that's what the writers do. So they sent me to write training films at Roach. And I did.
After the war, Al's screenwriting career took off. His first big writing credit was a 1948 Technicolor film, The Boy with Green Hair.
"Everywhere you go, people will say, they will say, there is the boy with the green hair. And then people will ask, why does he have green hair? So you will tell them, because I am a war orphan, and my green hair is to remind you that war is very bad for children."
With that film, Al was living his dream as a Hollywood screenwriter. But the dream was about to come to a halt. Al and Helen were members of the Hollywood chapter of the Communist Party. Al remembers gathering with a group of other writers who had been summoned to appear before the House Un-American Activities Committee.
By now, groups of us are meeting with subpoenas. And one of the attorneys said, "You know, it would be good if someone would announce the subpoena, because then we could start building rallies around it and do something to try to raise money for defense and other things, as well as educate, you know, the public." So at one of the meetings of the subpoenees, I said, "Look, I might as well announce it, because I know they know anyway, because it's clear from the reception I'm getting at the studios that they know."
Faced with the reality that he had been blacklisted, Al took a bold step. He'd fight back. He'd go to the press.
So I called The Hollywood Reporter and Variety to give him a statement. And both of them took it, but neither of them ran it. So I then called both of them to place an ad, and the reporter wouldn't even accept the ad. In fact, the guy at the reporter said, "Listen, are you married?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You got any kids?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Why don't you wise up?"
Eventually, he reached a sympathetic ad salesman at Variety who agreed to run his ad. Decades later, he showed it to Larry Saplaire.
Right. This is the issue of Variety of Thursday, August 30th, 1951. And the ad says, "Like most of you, I have been opposed to the Un-American Activities Committee for a long time. To change this attitude, now that it has been officially challenged by the committee's subpoena, would be dishonest. To cooperate by sacrificing others' careers for one's own would be degrading. To repudiate past ideas and associations, which dissent from the committee's standards of orthodoxy, branding oneself a dupe, would be humiliating. The course of dishonesty, degradation, and humiliation feeds the committee's insatiable hunger for publicity and aids in the ruin of the motion picture industry. The committee has demonstrated that it thrives on submissiveness and hysteria. I am with all who are for resistance and reason." And signed my name.
That kind of remarkable bravery is why I became so fascinated with Al and Helen Levitt. They, and everyone on the Hollywood blacklist of the 1940s and 50s, truly were canceled for decades. In listening more closely to Al Levitt, I was reminded of Larry Adler. Way back in season 3 of Revisionist History, I told a story about Adler, a man once billed as the greatest harmonica player in the world. In 1951, the same year Al Levitt placed his ad in Variety, Larry Adler was part of a group that went to Washington to protest the anti-communist hysteria sweeping through Hollywood. Now, mind you, unlike the Levitts, Larry Adler was not a communist, but he was accused of being one. Adler went bankrupt fighting McCarthyism. At the height of his career, he too was blacklisted, lost everything. He refused to name names. He moved his entire family to London, started over. And perhaps this is the path Al Levitt could have taken. Start over in a new place, refuse to compromise. But let's be honest, most people can't move to London and start their career all over again. That's why the oral histories with the Levitts are so revealing, because they get into the more typical reality of life after social ostracism. After Al was blacklisted, it seemed he might never work as a writer again. He took on odd jobs to keep his family afloat. But he also tried another approach, a front. He looked for someone who would attach their name to his work.
He kept coming to me with projects that he wanted me to write. But it was his project, his name would be on it, and presumably I would be paid if it ever sold. I hated everything. It was all really lousy stuff, and none of it ever sold. And I said to him, "Look, get a job. Try to get a job somewhere where you get paid, and I'll write the thing, and we'll split the money." So he got a job writing Colgate Comedy Hour. And then, as the show became successful, the more successful it became, the more he resented me.
As the resentment grew, Al's income plummeted, and the relationship between Al and his front became strained.
And one night, I was in bed at 11:30 or something, and the phone rings, and I pick it up, and it's him, and he said, "Get your ass over here." I said, "What's up?" He said, "Just get your ass over here." I forget, God, something is awful has happened. And I got up, got dressed, drove over to his house, came in. He was sitting there. He said, "Want a drink?" I said, "No, what happened?" He said, "Nothing happened." I said, "Well, what do you mean? What am I here for?" He said, "I just felt I wanted someone to talk to. I couldn't sleep." That's it. I said goodbye. that was the end of that.
Al Levitt needed a new way to work in Hollywood. He couldn't work with a front, but he also couldn't work under his own name. So he decided on a new one. His son Tom remembers this time.
My dad worked as a freelance photographer for a few years, you know, during the early part of the blacklist. And then he started writing again under the pseudonym Tom August, you know, derived from my first and middle name, Thomas Augustus. And I knew that I couldn't tell anybody, I couldn't tell any of my friends at school that my dad was a writer. I had to tell them that he was a photographer.
Al Levitt was now Tom August. And Tom August began to rack up credits, writing for TV sitcoms like The Brady Bunch and The Donna Reed Show. Scenes like these.
Oh, why don't you leave the dishes? I did. Doesn't it depress you to know that you'll have to face them later?
Not me. I believe in never doing the unpleasant today if you can possibly postpone it till tomorrow.
Was television, obviously it's different than movies, was it different good, different bad?
Different horrible.
Different,
it's the worst thing that's ever been invented from writer's point of view. I mean, it grinds you down. It has nothing to offer you but money. And even that is, you know, you have to work really fast to come out ahead on it.
So it wasn't the prolific career Al envisioned for himself, but he was finally working again. He was taking short money, the bare minimum pay for writers, just making enough to keep the lights on. But like everything else in the Levitts' lives, even this was tenuous. Al knew his cover could be blown at any moment. I don't think it's a coincidence that Al Levitt picked a name like Tom August for his pseudonym, because there was something else really obvious going on with the Hollywood blacklist. Why did Larry Adler wind up on the blacklist, even though he had nothing to do with communism? In 1975, Adler wrote an article for the New York Times titled, My Life on the Blacklist. He believed his crime was in having the same last name as a journalist in New York. That Adler was an alleged communist. All the Adlers had in common was they were Jewish. When Al Levitt took on the pen name Tom August, he was looking for a way to work in Hollywood without being beholden to a cranky, demanding front. But he was also sanitizing himself. He didn't choose Barry Leibowitz as a pen name, did he? He chose something generic, bland, unassuming, and Gentile. He distanced himself from communism, but also from his own identity. Ironically, as Larry Adler would later recall in an interview to the American Jewish Committee, his family name had already been sanitized.
I believe that the mother came from Kiev and father came from Odessa. Mm-hmm.
And that was the name Adler, right?
No, I don't think it was. I've been told by an aunt, and I've never bothered to check this closely, that our family name was Zelikovich. My grandfather,
Zelikovich.
With a Z. Mm-hmm. My grandfather bought a business, Adler's Dairy, and just appropriated the name Adler, and that was that, and so we became Adler.
Much has been said of the McCarthy era, a witch hunt that sought to uncover the communists living among us. But looking back now, it seems obvious, doesn't it? The blacklist sought to suppress ideology and free speech. But it took aim at one particular group, one that's easy to ID in a phone book. Thank you for listening to this subscriber-only edition of Revisionist History, and thank you for being a pushnik. Revisionist History is produced by Mia LaBelle, Lee Mengistu, with Anna Naim. Our editor is Julia Barton. Original scoring by Luis Guerra, mastering by Jason Gambrell. Special thanks to the Pushkin crew, Hedda Fain, Carly Migliori, Maya Koenig, Daniela Lacan, Maggie Taylor, Eric Sandler, Nicole Morano, and of course, Jacob Weisberg. I'm Malcolm Gladwell. Oh, and I've left out three crucial names, all of which, like Larry Adler and Al Levitt, were changed.
My name is Eloise Linton. My grandfather's last name was originally Lowenstein, and he was German-Jewish. He left Germany during the war and actually joined the British military. And they told him that he had to change his last name to sound less German or they would do it for him. So he sat down with the phone book and chose the name Linton.
So my given name is Amy Gaines, but I actually found out a few years ago that our family name was Ginsburg for like decades in America. And then at some point, I think in the early 50s, my grandfather made the decision to change his name from Norman Ginsburg to Norman Gaines. And so that's how I became Amy Gaines.
This is Jacob Smith. The family legend was that Smith was changed from Schmieder at Ellis Island, which is a legend a lot of Jewish families have, but as it turns out, one that's probably untrue. According to Google, Schmieder means tailor, and my great-grandfather was a tailor. My family most likely changed it themselves sometime after they immigrated to Brooklyn.